Welcome to In Difficult Times, a series of interviews with curious, inquisitive, and occasionally transcendent souls carving new paths through our current global crises. Your hosts for this exploit are Paul Reed and Anthony Gilbert.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the final episode in this short series on In Difficult Times, episode 6, I believe, and I'm here with Anthony Gilbert. Good morning, Anthony. How are things over in Colorado?
Things in Colorado are okay, reasonably.
Well, here in Devon, in the Southwest, we're in the midst of June, and what should be a warm summer's day is torrential rain and thunder outside, typical of this changeable climate, and perhaps a good lead into the changeability of life on the planet as we nudge ourselves forward under this pandemic. And perhaps today we get a chance to look back over the previous episodes in this short series and see where we're going with the lessons we've learnt. Anthony, what do you take from these series of interviews?
Well, interviews were really informative for me in terms of getting a sense of the global street level discussions that were going on. Remember, we started this podcast to consider not only COVID, but what was going on with economics and the environment and all of the crises that we're dealing with, because we're not just dealing with one health crisis right now. We're dealing with a social crisis, an environmental crisis, a economic crisis that has only been made worse by COVID, and some real political unrest still in the world. So I think for me personally, I look back at Rod's the first episode we did with Rod from Australia, and I really got a sense from that the Australians had a very mature approach to handling COVID that didn't seem to cause as much distress as it did. You know, locking down for them seemed to be okay, as opposed to what was going on in my country and what was going on in your country.
Certainly there was a feeling there that people felt if they could do something for the good of the community, they would do it. It was almost it wasn't something you would even question. It was just something that you automatically did. And that was refreshing, I think, for us both to hear.
Well, you know, we have this sense of Australia, at least in this country, we have this sense of Australia as being the rugged people, you know? And what I got from Rod was a sense of that ruggedness with a lot of maturity behind it, which was really was. I think, you know, we saw when we spoke with Mark Saunders, who from you know, my compadre from here in Colorado, and Mark gave us some real good information about how to stay healthy during COVID. And I thought that was, you know, again, if it was going to happen, it was going to happen at the street level. While we were all waiting for vaccines and waiting for, you know, the politicians in this country, particularly, to get their heads out of their backside, Mark was saying, okay, on a day-to-day basis, this is the things that I was doing to stay healthy, you know, which I think.
Those very simple tips I remember about eating and shopping, those basic ideas we talked about were things that we could all do to help our immune system. And as you say, in the long term, address some of the imbalances that are prevalent in our Western diets. Mm-hmm.
Which takes us to Josie, who seemed to take the opportunity to deepen her spiritual practice through this. That again, you know, another viewpoint of when dealing with crisis and dealing with unexpected change, what can you do to maintain yourself? And here's a person who said, okay, you know, I'm not going to be able to teach. I'm going to have to teach online. I'm not going to be able to meet with my community. I'm going to connect with my community online, and I'm going to have a lot of time to myself. So I'm going to deepen my spiritual practice, which in the end, you know, is better for me. You know, so, you know, I was inspired by Josie.
Very much, very much. Someone who really did embrace as much as she could of the changes that were going on in her life and brought them to a focal point in which she could take everything further and explore and just delve into a new opportunity there when she was talking about learning Spanish in order to be able to communicate with a group of people that she wanted to teach, embracing the technology to see how that would be able to help connect, even to the point of looking to see ways in which she could connect on an emotional level and spiritual level through the use of that technology. All very interesting and hopeful for what may be part of our long-term strategy for dealing with the future.
I agree. She did have a very hopeful tone. It's something that I've seen in her before. And it was great to see that it wasn't quenched by all of the stress that was going on in the world at that time. And JT did something very similar. JT, before COVID, was dealing with the idea that he had some health issues, and he embraced the whole foods approach to living. Very similar to the book I read a couple of years ago, Forks Over Knives. And there's a lot of research that goes into that. The notion of eating whole foods, mostly vegetables, no processed foods. And he had, I think when we spoke with him, he had lost 25, 30 pounds. Using the isolation of COVID to do stuff like have a little bit of extra time to prepare a meal, have a little bit of extra time to do his practice, and overall improve his health. So,
yes, and I think he'd begun to use social media as a way to communicate more with people. I remember him offering Qigong classes, I think it was every morning on Facebook for free. He started meditation classes, giving out as much as he possibly could to help not only his own health, but to help those people that were in contact with him. And again, a fine example of someone who didn't have all the resources of the world at his disposal, but used what he had and used those things effectively.
I agree. So that may be what the lessons learned during COVID, to use time differently, to use to expand one's abilities when in the face of stress. I mean, let's face it, other than cultivating my beard, I don't feel like I've done much cultivation work through, I cultivated the beard during COVID.
Not the only one. I know someone who had a YouTube channel set up about beard care, and it was purely during the COVID period. So,
I didn't know beard care was a thing until I had a beard. You know, when I used to have a short beard in college, you brush it out in the morning. It's okay, but this requires, I've got about 3 inches of hair, 3 inches of hair. This requires some work every morning.
But going back just for a moment, that what you just said there, and you know, I think that reminds us, we came into this thing, this series of podcasts, and we came into this idea of producing these from a background of mindful practices of some description. And in my case, that's predominantly Tai Chi. And one of the definitions I would imagine that we would all like to employ, certainly it's there in Tai Chi with any of the movement-based disciplines, and that is, how do we cope with stress when it comes to us? Because it will probably come at an unexpected time, and it will probably come in a way that we won't expect it. So what tools have we got that will enable us to deal with it as best as we can? And in a sense, our four guests all stepped forward with different versions of those different techniques that they were employing in their practices. What about yours?
My practice has been pretty stable. I definitely, through COVID, found myself using meditation and Qigong sometimes as a crutch, you know, in the sense that it was something I could do even at the times when I felt like things were a little bleak. I could use this to normalize my day. So whereas I may have not changed my practice. So, you know, getting up every morning, I do 40 minutes of movement and 30 minutes of meditation. So through COVID, clearly there were some challenges to do that. The whole family was home. There was no place to get away from anybody. So I found myself getting up a bit earlier, making adjustments like that. But then when it got difficult, I used that repetition and that pattern of getting up every morning and doing practices. It gave myself some sense of purpose, you know, and that allowed me to continue on being a creative individual, being able to produce the work that I needed to produce, you know, clearly having, you know, conversations with other people, reaching out. We conceived this whole plan to do this podcast during COVID. You know, it should be, you know, so for me, that's what meditation became. It was that mindfulness practice became the touchstone, more so because it kept me moving through times when it was just difficult and I felt like, you know, well, why should I bother? I'm just laying in bed all day. I don't have any place to be. I don't have to go anywhere. But it got me out and it got me up, you know, so that dedication that I built up over decades of practice. At times, I'm not going to lie, at times it was difficult. And at times, like everybody else, I was worried about where we were going. But I used that sometimes as a crutch, get up and make sure that I could do things. And I have to say, you know, this last 9 months may have been some of the most productive time that I've had.
Wow. That's saying something.
Yeah.
And it's just the start, I'm sure, for you.
Yeah, there'll be other.
Yeah, time. I mean, I do think that, I suppose, in my case, I was already self-employed. I was working from home. I was already producing material from home. So when COVID hit, although I wasn't in this country, I was in Spain, as I've said before, it didn't matter where I was because as long as I've got my camera, my microphone, and my laptop, I can continue to produce. What enabled me to normally produce was the balance of that intensive home self-absorbent work and then going out and socializing and being amongst people. When you took away that element to it, it became for me a very unhealthy practice. And I had to think very carefully about how I was going to get through this creative period, where was I going to get the resources I needed to continue to be motivated to do the work? So I set myself a goal to produce a new course, of which I'm still running through at the moment, and to move my teaching online to a new platform, to create a membership site, etc. So that's been a huge challenge for me, but one that's kept me well motivated. And each month now, well, every week I'm producing content for that new platform and still producing the course material for the new online course. So that's all going fine in terms of I'm moving and I'm practicing more. On a personal basis, I felt that I had to, like you, put aside a specific time of the day because it felt so structureless otherwise that if I didn't artificially create these segments of space in the day. So at this point of the day, I would do this work. At that point of the day, I would go and do my own practice, some Tai Chi, some meditation, some Qigong, some stretching, whatever it was. But it had to be a specific time of the day that I knew I'd have this alarm going off in my head and I would go and do it. Otherwise, it just drifted around, you know, and floated about. And I felt extremely unproductive in that way. I suppose the flip side of this was feeling the responsible for everything, you know, responsible for my health, responsible for my diet, responsible for whether I'm going to be alive or not. If I didn't maintain social distancing, if I didn't wear my mask, did I wash my mask enough times? Did I wash my hands enough times? Did I disinfect my hands before or coming out or going back in or after touching that? Was I doing enough practice at home to build my own immune system, given I know that, like many people, we've all got immune systems that are vulnerable? So given my age, given my background, given my geographical location. So I suppose part of me just felt like without being able to go out and connect with people and let go of that, I felt super responsible for everything, absolutely everything. And I think that felt very much a heavy weight to bear.
Well, time took on different meanings during this. You know, when our patterns of behavior were disrupted. And for me, I noticed that time was different. It seemed like there was more of it because clearly my obligations to the outside world were less. And like you, again, I tried to create structures, but I found myself in those moments when I was connecting with people, like going to the supermarket, Now, I'm one of the guys who I cook and I do the shopping. And that's realistically probably a survival mechanism because April can't cook. I love her, but she can't cook. And I grew up in a restaurant family. So there's a big gulf between, you know, a distance between, you know, the way I cook and the way she cooks. Her kids don't want her to cook. So for me, going out and doing shopping became a ritual. Every Friday morning, going out and doing shopping. And what I noticed through the COVID event was that I wanted to extract as much, mindfully wanted to extract as much out of that moment as possible. Because it was the only hour, or let's say hour and a half, because I tend to shop multiple supermarkets. Only hour and a half a week that I got to look somebody else who wasn't a family member in the eyes.
Yeah.
And so I took it upon myself to say that, you know, everybody's going to a ton of people. I'm going to be as polite as humanly possible, you know, and try to make it so that people could see me smiling just through my eyes, that I was looking at, that I was seeing them at a time when we were all so inwardly focused. And that became a practice for me. I took, I may actually write something about it at some point, but I would take notes on that event. Like every Friday morning, I come home from shopping, put the groceries away, have a cup of tea, and just write down some notes of just how I interacted with people where they couldn't see half my face, and how either positive or, and I never really felt anything negative. There was one moment at a Home Depot where somebody was spouting some political nonsense, and I felt obligated to open my mouth, but that's primarily because I'm a New Yorker at heart. So other than that, all the reactions that I had with people were positive. You know, we and people seem to be thankful that somebody looked out past that. So for me, I have a very different sense of the moment. That's what COVID taught me. You know, the moment is important, and you can extract more from the moment than you can say, you know, if you're just kind of half paying attention to it. So that for me was the big lesson for COVID was be more present and be more aware.
Here now, live in the present. Yeah, all those cliches, I mean, they do become meaningful sometimes under moments of stress in our lives. They actually resonate suddenly on a meaningful level. Yes. And way before, it's just something you scroll past on your Instagram timeline as, oh my God, not another, you know, Lao Tzu quote on such and such. But, you know, sometimes you need an external event to anchor them to and to make sense of.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if anything, you know, what we should all take out of this is that we are one community. You know, what happens in my country inevitably is going to impact your country. What happens in your country is inevitably going to impact my country. And throughout the world, you know, like you were speaking before we started recording, of, you know, how things have opened up in Europe and people are traveling back and forth, and tourist industry is trying to jumpstart itself at a time when you guys are dealing with the Delta variation, which really hasn't had much of a showing yet in our country. We're aware of it. I'm aware of it because it started, you know, the first recorded infection of the Delta variation came through Denver. So that's why I'm aware of it. You're not really hearing about it. You know? Well, Denver International Airport is a hub, so if you're flying in from many places, you'll come into the center of the country. It's really only if you're flying into JFK or Boston, you're usually coming directly out of Europe. But for other places, this is essential.
Is there much international travel going on at the moment between the U.S. and the rest of the world, or is it not?
It's not something I've been paying attention to. I think for a lot of Americans, when President Trump got out of office and it became less the me show, we also had this collective sigh of relief that, you know, we felt like we had an adult back in the office. And we stopped paying attention to what was going on in the national scene and started paying a little bit more attention to ourselves. I think that for Americans particularly, I think for at least 60% of Americans that voted against him, the statement was, you know, it seemed to me like the government was too much about President Trump and not enough about Americans. His daily tweet storm was all very self-centered, almost as a kind of deflection against what was else, the seriousness of the moment. And so I have to say personally, now that he's out of office and I don't have a tweet storm happening every morning that I have to pay attention to, I'm okay letting President Biden run the country because I feel like he's responsible, get things done, and I can start focusing on healing myself and dealing with, my own scars from this event. Like many people, I lost people I love during this. And I think that being able to have that collective moment where we can be a little self-reflective is important for Americans right now. So no, I'm not really paying attention to who's traveling where. I know I have plans traveling where.
Did you see your president in the United Kingdom? I think it was last week.
Yes, I did.
He was attending the G7 conference, and they made these declarations about environmental concern, etc. Interestingly, it took part in a part of the United Kingdom called Cornwall, which is a region in the far west. It's my neighbouring region from Devon. And in Cornwall, there has been, since the outset of COVID, one of the lowest rates throughout the country. For whatever reason, because it's largely rural, there's not many urban centres, and people have been very good at following guidelines. In the week that the G7 international conference took place in Cornwall and the world's political leaders turned up, the rate of infection, I think, multiplied by about 5. So now Cornwall is in the top level of infections in the whole country, as thousands of police officers were brought in, the media, the world's media, the politicians, their staff, etc., etc. And in so this very small rural area, in particular two towns in which they held these meetings, the rates of infection have just gone through the roof in 7 days in that sit period. So it's over, but it's left scars. And interestingly for us all in the country, the media attention that was given to the G7 leaders about how they were addressing the issues of the day was remembered probably most strongly by these off-camera capturing moments of backslapping and hugging each other and shaking hands, and the Queen coming along and everyone having a chat in very small groups. Well, in some cases there was up to 20 or 30 people in the same photograph or moment, none wearing masks, everybody connecting and touching each other. At the very same time, we were being told we mustn't gather in bigger numbers than X amount. We mustn't touch each other. We certainly mustn't shake hands or slap backs. We mustn't embrace or kiss, and we must keep our masks on. So part of me is feeling the same, although it's not something that I politically share. I can understand the frustrations of people now saying, there is one rule for those people in power, and there is another rule for us underneath it. Because every time we're told we can't do something, we see examples of those people in power carrying out doing that for themselves. And this week alone, we've just had the health secretary of the government forced to resign yesterday because he was discovered, not because he admitted it, but because a camera caught him having an illicit affair with a member of his team at a time in which he had personally just come off the stage saying to everyone, you mustn't embrace or touch anybody that's not part of your family circle. And there he was having an affair with his secretary. So I think there's a sense of hypocrisy there, and it's this sense of which, you feel you've just given up like you say, you've lost people. You've lost people who are close to you. You've sacrificed a lot. You've seen your businesses possibly collapse in the wake of all of this, and you're still being told to limit what you can do. Part of me thinks, are we going to see any manifestation of change? Is there anything more that we're going to encounter, do you think, in this? Are we going to experience, or are we going to demand better accountability out of this crisis?
Well, that's it. I think it has to come down to, are we going to demand more accountability? No one's going to give us accountability. Accountability has never been something that people will give away for free. You have to make people accountable. Now, how does that happen? I don't know. I don't see a lot of maturity in politics these days. I don't see a lot of conversation about the common good. I see a lot of finger pointing. I see a ton of misdirection. And I don't think it's limited to either party in this country. I think it's both parties with different messages, of course. So I clearly have a bias for one party over the other at this point, but I think the people need to realize that this is what it comes down to. We're fighting the notion of tribalism. We have tribes when we should have a global community. It's the friggin' 21st century, you know. An American entrepreneur is going to be the first person to create a colony on Mars. At least seemingly, it looks like, I think, unless the Chinese get there first. But you know, where major things are happening, and yet our day-to-day politics are driven by tribalism, and we need to get past the notion of the tribe. You know, and I'm not saying we should be socialists or give up our individuality. I'm an extreme individualist, but there is a point where the individual must take responsibility for the community, and the community must take responsibility for the individual. It has to go both ways. And for far too long, the community has always kind of looked at the individual and went, well, you're not conforming, you know, so clearly you're bad. But I mean, you need both conformity and novelty to have a well-functioning system. You know, we look at the world as an ecosystem. Even the human ecosystem needs both conformity and novelty. So the individual and the community have to exist. They have to coexist. And we need more mature politicians for that. And I'm not seeing a whole bunch of them right now on anybody's stage. You know, and, you know, Prime Minister Johnson needs a haircut. I mean, somebody needs to style his hair. I'm sorry. You know, you're going to stand up.
I think he's certainly a slovenly creature of which takes no pride. And he's part of a certain elite, Anthony, that were publicly educated. And in this country, publicly educated doesn't mean publicly educated. It means privately educated. But we have this twist on terms. He went to one, like most of his cabinet, went to extremely privileged private educational schooling. And out of that comes this disheveled sort of, I don't care about these sorts of things. I'm more interested in ideas and projects and schemes. And look at me, I'm a bit strange to look at, but that's all part of my eccentricity of the upper classes of the English elite. And he's representative of that. He's one of just a line of people that exist on that plane. He's also an adulterer. And I'm not saying this because it's just my opinion. It's because he's been found to have numerous affairs with different people. He's had and continues to have. When asked publicly about how many children he had, he said, I wasn't sure. Mm-hmm. And he's an ex-journalist who, and this is a very, very well-known fact, he was a journalist at the time of the Brexit split, and he composed two articles, one of which said, why I'm so pleased we didn't leave Europe, and one saying, why I'm so pleased we did. And he just waited to see what the result was, and then he showed that one. this is his face, the way that politics is. He's this sort of weather vane. He just goes wherever public teaches him.
You have the same thing in this country too, where politics has become really situational. You know, look at a perfect example. I mean, look at all of the conservative Christians who flock to Trump, who will denounce for anybody else, denounce adulterism, denounce having multiple wives, in terms of getting divorced and remarrying, will denounce a kind of lavish lifestyle, talking about keeping life simple and doing God's work. And then they flock to Trump because he's willing to give them, or he's willing to at least say, I'm going to give you X, and X is something that they want. And then all of that goes out the window and they embrace the adulterer, guy who admits to having a relationship with a porn star after saying he wasn't going to have a relationship with a porn star, or that he didn't. It's almost comical theater. And I think that, mass media and the consumption of mass media has definitely changed the way politicians behave. Because if you go back 50 years, politicians were very different people. They were more straight-laced. They were more the type of person you felt you could rely on. And I look at this guy Getz coming out of Florida, who, is a Republican who supports the pot lobby. I don't understand that at all. Probably because they fly him to Bermuda, where he hooks up with, underage girls, and then lies about it, and is trying to create a whole false narrative while the FBI puts together a review of his behavior as to whether or not he actually did, traffic a young girl out of the country to have sex with her. I mean, so and again, the people who say that they are very moral go out and flock to these types of people, as opposed to morality and ethics having a set meaning and you follow it. And so it's all become very situational. This is who I am in this situation. This is who I am in that situation. And what you end up with, if you're an acute observer of politics, what you end up with is people who have multiple masks, which are all about self-service. I don't remember the writer who did it, but I know he was a Republican operative, and it was an article published in Mother Jones magazine, where he said that the modern Republican Party is all about the acquisition of power without purpose. And I think that it goes beyond the Republican Party. I think it really goes to most of the global elite. It's the acquisition of power without purpose. Whereas, and again, maybe I'm drinking the Kool-Aid on this one, but if you go back 50 years, I think that it was the acquisition of power for platform. We set up, this is our agenda, this is what we're going, this is what we tell the American people we want, and we acquire power to fulfill the agenda. Whereas now, it's really about just getting ahead, getting by. I want to be elite, I want to be at the top. And that's the message that you send to a lot of young people, let's face it, I know one guy in our Congress, Ohio representative, I want to say his name is Tim Ryan. I could be wrong about this, but he has actually authored papers and a book on mindfulness in relationship to helping military men overcome PTSD. So there's a guy who's probably not going to get very far in his party, but who, at least I know, is doing yoga and meditation probably semi-regularly, and I could at least believe in. But I have to wonder if that's just not another mask, while he's, somebody else. And what I think we want more, and I think even the younger generation is screaming this, is that we want more authenticity, right or left, conservative or liberal, just be authentic. I just chucked back an expletive, yes. Okay.
I don't want to see this become purely a political conversation, although much as I'm personally fascinated by this subject of authenticity in politics, we've just recently lost a leader on the Labour Party side who was probably the most authentic politician in my lifetime, and he was systematically destroyed by the media for a whole series of intentional reasons to displace him from the leadership of that party. And so as much as I'm in agreement with the need for that authenticity, I do worry that the power that rests outside of the political structure, both in economic and media circles, wield so much influence that when we do have leaderships that are authentic, I'm not sure they'll ever reach a position of power. And I suppose that brings us back down to this idea of community again, because whilst we still sit on our backsides and vote once every 4 years in the hope that we're going to get change on this in this political means, we don't do anything in between. We don't take control ourselves of what needs to be done in our communities. We don't connect with each other. We don't form the associations that are probably necessary on a local basis for us to actually implement and feel empowered by doing so, and recognize that that's where power really rests, with ourselves and with each other. All the time we're hoping for the savior to come along, I think we're going to be disappointed. Just a personal little chicken there, but
I think if COVID, let's look at what's going on in the world. We have a health crisis, a global health crisis. We have a global economic crisis. We have a global political crisis in terms of, you know, oligarchy versus democracy. It's really seeing the first serious push in my lifetime against liberal democracy. And at the same time, we have social crises going on with, this type of bigotry against, you know, almost anybody who doesn't fit, you know, this narrow criteria of what X is. And I think that's different across the globe, but, you know, we're not embracing each other. So all of this, to me, it seems happening at one time should refocus our attention back on ourselves. Because, right, it's only going to happen, you know, if you want to achieve peace in your life, if you want to achieve wellness, if you want to thrive, if you want to be a creative powerhouse, those things are only going to happen if you cultivate yourself. If you cultivate your relationships with people on the street level, you know, not worrying about this crap that's going on. I was thinking about, like, what would, and this is strange because I don't often do this, but I was, so here's the evolution of this. I was going through some paperwork from my last book, and another writer who I'm very friendly with and I've studied with, just sent me, and this is what happens, those of you who kind of are writers, when you ask for endorsements, people will often send you a page of endorsements and you have to cut out what you want to use in the book. So this gentleman sent me a page of endorsements, and one of the things, and as I was kind of cleaning out this file, one of the things I read on there, he goes, well, is Anthony Gabera is a person who I could see being very comfortable walking through 5th century China. And I was thinking to myself, well, I'm really not, would not be comfortable with 5th century China, but what a nice thing to say, you know? But I started thinking about what would a true Taoist, old school, an OG Taoist, what would they have to say about the world that we're living in? And I started to really wonder if all of this isn't just the environment, you know, and we've got to move through it. You know, the political structure down is really always going to be controlled by people who are seeking power, seeking fame, seeking fortune, seeking some privilege that they can't seem to afford themselves without all of the other trappings that go along with power. And the Taoist, being an extremely self-empowered being, is just looking at all of that as landscape. And I started wondering, really, you know, is this just the landscape? Is the current political, socioeconomical, you know, what is authentic? What is not authentic? Where should I put my energy? Where should I not put my energy? So it all becomes landscape. And I think if you can detach from it as landscape, I mean, detach from it as being anything other than landscape, you can actually affect some change differently, or you can do things differently. You can empower yourself to act differently in the landscape that you're walking on right now. And then, you know, choose where to plug your energy into the landscape so that you can affect those things that mean something to you. Now, if you have, and I think this is one of the problems that we have when people are overly political, is that they take on these meanings, they take on these issues that will just get them more votes, but they really don't do anything for the issue. You know, you don't see a influx in money going to that issue or anything like that. It's the window dressing of the day. But if you don't behave like that and you actually say, here's where I want to enact change. I have constructed my life so that I have a certain amount of power. I'm going to put change into helping others improve their health, or I'm going to put change into helping, disadvantaged people be more advantaged. You know, you can surgically use energy and use your life to make a difference, as opposed to, you know, just coming into this and trying to create window dressing that gets you to the next election. But that took a different type of person. I don't know. I mean, but I think you're right. To get back to your point, is that the only thing that we can really do now is cultivate ourselves. You know, the change that we want to see in the world, to quote Gandhi, has to start with us. You know, and then
it's quite interesting that history, isn't it? That my understanding of the concept of Wu Wei in Taoism has always been not unsimilar to what you've described, that observation of landscape, that observation of change, the observation of patterns of movement that are going through, and then deliberately considering where best to intervene into that landscape and at what time can you be most useful by doing so, as opposed to just endlessly getting involved for the sake of appearances. So that idea is there, and partly maybe that's what, to bring us in a big circle round to where we started and perhaps where we should be thinking of finishing as well, is the idea of in difficult times being something on as a representation of that idea. It emerged out of a moment in which we felt there could be some interest in talking about these issues. And as we conclude this series, you know, we're going to go back to observing the landscape once more and potentially or not intervening again at some later stage. It all depends.
See how it goes. Yeah, I agree. I think, I consider myself a keen observer of reality. I think that's what being a Taoist is in the 21st century. Now, if you go back and you look at all of the teachings, all of the practices, all the meditations that are considered Taoist from all the different traditions that have existed for the last 2000 years, it is all about becoming much more aware of the environment that you live in and how you move through. So that, you know, you're not creating actions, but you are still moving through things and being of benefit, you know, to what actually authentically moves you. So yeah, let's go back to, you know, I think both of us have been keen observers of the political, socioeconomic landscape of Europe and America. Yeah, if I can leave anybody with anything through this whole process, is that, you know, the things that we've seen are because we observe. You know,
because of what?
The things that we've seen, the comments that we've made, the guests that we've chosen, all of that comes out through a lens of being the observer and wanting to see and know more. And, you know, moving forward, that's what people need to do. People, you know, be a keen observer of reality, and you won't be, you know, you'll see through most of the nonsense. You know, you'll learn and see where you want to actually put your energy, you know, and then do so and be authentic about it. Yeah, and
good advice. And don't forget, listeners, always find yourself a good black backdrop, because it just accentuates exactly what it's all about. The Tao, it's all about knowing when and where and what to wear and what color. And black, politically interesting political color. I won't go into the history of it now, but
next time.
Perhaps in a follow-up series we'll address that issue. But yes, I think, you know, if I was to say one, leave anything, one comment, I probably would be at loss as to say what to do, really, apart from it's never been more clearer to me how much we need to be critically observant of what we're told is happening. I don't mean, you know, picking up a copy of New Scientist and browsing through it. I mean, the news at 10 on the TV. Never has there been so many agendas that are conflicting and are self-serving, as Anthony has said, that we have to be very, very skeptical about and find ways and means for us to communicate amongst ourselves and empower ourselves by doing so and strengthen our bonds by doing so. And these sorts of platforms, podcasting, broadcasting in this way, is one of those tools that we have, and it's good that we are able to use it.
Well, let me leave it on this then. I hope you've enjoyed In Difficult Times. If you have any questions, ideas, or would like to share some information with us, there is a form on the website that you can shoot us a note. We look for, reach out and let us know how you enjoyed the series, and probably be a big boost as to whether or not we continue on with this project.
Yeah. Thank you for listening and your time. And it's been a pleasure, Anthony. I've really enjoyed it. And hopefully we'll continue in some form or another.
Oh, you'll find it. Be well, everybody.
This has been In Difficult Times. We thank you for lending us your attention. It's a small yet appreciated gift, and we wish you well in the days and months ahead.